I'd like to introduce to you tonight, for those of you who have not met Malefi, Pastor Malefi Selle. Malefi spells his last name T-S-E-L-E, or pronounces it Selle, did I? Malefi's 34 years of age. He's an ordained pastor of the, it's easy for us to remember, Evangelical Lutheran Church of South Africa. Was arrested in December of 1986 under the Security Act in South Africa, which meant that anyone could be arrested. They need not be charged or convicted of any crime, and was held in prison for 2 years without ever being charged or brought to trial. And was finally released in December of 1988. One of the things that I neglected to mention tonight when I told this little story was that I did mention that Holden had been very significant, had a significant part in this drama, and that many letters were written on Malefi's behalf by Holden people. And one of the people that spearheaded that effort was a woman who was the village pastor of Holden at that time, whose name is Barbara Rossi, who happens to be our summer program director this summer. But it was under her leadership that much of the letter writing was done here at Holden. We've asked Malefi if he would be willing to share some things about this very difficult time in his life, and then be open to any questions any of you might have about this experience. And so, Malefi, we're deeply grateful that for the next hour, 55 minutes, we might sit together in this way and that you're willing to share with us. Thank you.
Thank you, brothers and sisters. It is with a truly great reluctance that I am sharing with you this episode in my life. Reluctance primarily because it's one of those things that I wish can fade in my memory if I can help it, but also because the nature of the struggle in South Africa and the costs that many people have had to pay is so great that whenever I think about my own contribution, I'm always reminded that it is insignificant to what many people, close friends that I know, have gone through. So I do ask you not to regard it as a model, or for that matter as any way whatsoever some form of self-glorification, that I also should be counted as one of those people who have paid to end apartheid. I think mine was really, really a groovy train compared to the torture chambers that many of my friends, close acquaintance, have gone through. However, I do believe that for reasons that Holden Village had a particular ministry with regards to my case, it may be useful that I share with you, and maybe some of you can gain strength to do similar work in future, and some of you can also learn about the situation in South Africa, which you only encounter in newspapers. Having said that, it certainly does give me great pleasure to sit in front of people who I know have worked for years, have prayed for years for people like myself in my situation, and it is in that with those preliminary remarks that I would invite you to share with me my prison memos. It all began in the early hours of December 12, 1986, at about 3 o'clock in the morning, with a loud knock on the door and windows. I knew that it was the police. Actually, I had been expecting them to arrest me since June 1986, after most of my colleagues were arrested. I managed to survive because I successfully evaded arrest for 6 months by living at different places, each and every night sleeping at a different place, by wearing different disguises, by changing cars with friends so that I don't drive one car on two successive days. And it was an agreement that we made with some of my colleagues that in the organization in which the government wanted to arrest all of us, we agreed that we must make it a point that not all of us are arrested at the same time. So during that time, it was my turn to sit with that I'm not arrested. Others were arrested at that time. And it was towards December, I relaxed my security because one of them was released. And I thought, well, if they come after me, at least somebody else is there. And indeed, they came. That is why I was expecting them. Mudiehi opened for them as they knocked. And about 12 security policemen went into the house holding guns, and they asked me to identify myself. And at that time they spoke very politely but very threatening. There was no way that I could tell them lies. I realized on the spot that I just have to be very honest with them. I told them, "You're looking for Mulefetsile, you're speaking to him, can I help you?" To which they immediately said that, well, we are here to detain you under emergency regulations. And at that time, my whole body and mind was numb. I had no will to argue with them, to question them, for how long, where are you taking me? I just volunteered to anything they wanted and they said. They searched the house for 2 hours, trying to find something incriminating, and they found nothing. And they advised me to pack some of my personal belongings because I may be away for some time. They did not indicate for how long. And I just packed a few tracksuits, 2 change of clothing, washing rack, etc. And when they took me to this headquarters of the security police in Johannesburg, which is popularly known as John Foster Square. Now, interestingly enough, this is one of the security headquarters where since 1977, I think more than 17 to 20 people have died in those police headquarters. Some of them, they fell from the 9th floor. Some of them, it is alleged they hanged themselves in the cells. And when you enter that building, you get scared. But I was numb. I went through a process of taking photos, fingerprinting, getting information, etc., etc. Who's my nearest relative? Who are my parents? All I just told them what they told me. And my first traumatic reaction was when they locked me inside my cell. And then it dawned to me that I am in prison, and that I started withdrawing into a deep depression. I couldn't eat immediately thereafter. I had no appetite for anything. They brought some soft porridge and coffee. I couldn't take anything. I couldn't sleep. Every little movement which was happening outside the cells, I was very alert. Whenever footsteps were approaching or a key was opening one of the doors there, I just thought maybe they're coming to me, they're coming after me. And my whole body, I was just tense. It was then that I started feeling terrible. And every little minute and every hour seemed very long time. Let me make a few remarks about the cell that I was taken into. It was a fairly big cell, normally for four people, which was just bare, completely bare, nothing. Walls and a toilet seat at the corner. That was all. They took me into that cell with a carpet, a mat, which I was going to use as my mattress of this, and three blankets. I had to lay it on top of that mat. The other one I used it as a pillow, and the other one on top of me. And that was all. The blankets were very dirty. They've been used for many, many years, various prisoners. Some of them had blood and which had dried, smelling. You had no choice and no option. That was it. The prison is an old prison, which is very dirty. It has mice. And when the first time one comes through in the cell, you jump, and then you suddenly grow to see them as the only companions that can come into your cell. The cell had window blinds. It had no light coming in. The light in the cell was on for 24 hours. And there was a video camera which was surveying, which would kept me in surveillance for 24 hours throughout my stay in the cell. Whenever I'm asleep, whenever I'm anything that I'm doing, they were watching what was happening. And every 2 hours, every night, they would knock and check whether you are still alive. So you wouldn't sleep without any interruption from whatever, from 8 o'clock until the following morning. They come at 8 o'clock, they would knock, and when they knock, you must raise your head to show that you are still alive. You don't only just peep and see. So your kind of sleep is like that. You sleep in relays of 2 hours. What depressed me even more was the dead silence in that prison. It's a security prison. The people they hold there, all of them are security prisoners, not common law prisoners. And out of that silence, you'd hear someone screaming from some cell along the corridor, and you'd never go back to sleep again after that. I mean, you'd hear that piercing scream come. I was really, when I saw this Romero today, I mean, I just couldn't take it. It just brought back what is happening there. And you'll torture somebody in the same floor with you, and you just feel that you can't take it any longer. Why don't they come after you? And it would happen just like that. And you'd never know who else is in that prison, even the person next door to you. Because whenever they move you out of the cell, they must lock all the doors. So that you never know. It might be your wife next door, you'll never know. And very soon, all these kinds of screams became regular. I came to know that, well, it does happen, I'm in prison. After being locked in for 3 days, they started with interrogations. The very interesting thing happened about my interrogation, that unlike the interrogations that I've gone through before in the past, this time it was very interesting that my interrogation, all of it, they brought very sophisticated people to, rather than interrogate me in the way of accusing me, they wanted information. They were simply interrogating me like, what do you people mean when you say you don't want this kind of education? What kind of education? If you were the Minister of Education, what kind would you want? So actually they used that interrogation to get more information rather than an aggressive, incriminating kind of interrogation to say, who did this? Who burned this house? Where were you? You know, not that type of interrogation. And so one ended up being relaxed, although of course, as it happens with every form of interrogation, their line of thinking is that you are a communist. And they were convinced that I'm a communist. And more than that, they would believe that they would say that, Reverend, we know that people like you, you wouldn't do all this nonsense happening in the country. But you are actually a front for some people who don't want them, who don't want to appear. And that front they spoke about was the ANC, the African National Congress. At that time, it was a banned organization. And to be known to be doing any activities of the ANC, you will be sentenced for 8 years. And then the interrogations went on to include liberation theology, to include Kairos document, which was very interesting. And I told them where I thought I can give whatever they want. After interrogations, which lasted 2 days, I was taken back to the cells where I was told that I'm going to rot. And I never saw a single policeman for the next 7 months. It was as if sometimes I really thought I've been forgotten. I just thought maybe those people made a mistake, they've forgotten that I'm here. How, why is, for such a long time they don't even come to say, you did this, why did you do it? I mean, it was just silent, day in, day out. It was painful because I would think maybe they will come tomorrow. And to go on week, month, for 7 solid months, nothing happened. And it was the most difficult period of my 2-year detention. In between, life was not a bed of roses because my cell was constantly searched, the diet was poor, and above all, I had nothing to read. At this time, my lawyer received an explanation from the Minister of Law and Order as to the reasons for my arrest. And I want you to listen very carefully to the reasons that the Minister of Law and Order gave, why he is actually detaining me.
Sorry. With reference to your letter dated the 21st of July, 1988, I wish to advise that according to information at my disposal, Mr. Tsele was treasurer of the National Education Crisis Committee and the most active executive member of this organization. The NECC is an organization intent on undermining and replacing the existing official and community structures, especially the educational system, and to replace the latter with an alternative one, commonly known as, quote, people's education. This is in accordance with calls made by the banned African National Congress. The NECC furthermore supports all rent and consumer boycotts and the implementation of, quote, street committees. These committees are groups of radicals intent on undermining and replacing the existing official and community structures with alternative ones. By his active participation in the activities of the NECC, Mr. Tsele endangered and undermined the maintenance of public order, the safety of the public, and the termination of the state of emergency. Yours faithfully, Adrian Flock, Ministry of Law and Order.
After 7 months in solitary confinement, I was transferred to another prison where I was placed with other detainees. Many of them were young boys of between 17 and 20 years. It made a great difference. My spirits were raised. I was able to talk to other people. I became a human being again. At this stage, let me explain the rationale behind the detention system. The government was under increasing pressure, especially from the youth and students who opposed its policies at that time. Actually, when they declared the state of emergency, they simply couldn't govern the country any longer. Now, because of this, because the opposition was very widespread, they detained everybody who happened to belong to a particular age group that they thought was behind. So you don't have to, didn't have to do anything, didn't have to be have been at the wrong place, simply by being within 16 and 21 years age of old, years old, they would take you to prison. And these are the young people that I met. The strategy was to remove the youth from the townships, to restore stability, and to release them one by one, testing the water. As soon as they see that the opposition is rising again, they would take them away again, etc., etc. And I need not mention that they're not being charged. They just go to prison and they will release them one by one. And I was detained myself with my other committee members simply because they believed that we had an influence on the youth because we're working in an education committee. We're working together with student organizations. Therefore, in line with this strategy, their plan with detention was to break you down, to change you. In other words, if you believe apartheid is wrong, you must, after spending time in detention, believe that there is nothing wrong with apartheid. And they intended to isolate you from the community, to make you appear like an outcast to the community. And where detention fails, where they fail to change you or break you down, you'll simply be silenced by disappearing. And we've had many detainees who disappeared from prison and we're told that they ran away. So in line with this plan, attempts were made on us whilst we were in prison to change us, to co-opt us, to make us informers. And I'm sad to say many, many were just broken. They simply couldn't take it any longer. They gave in. Some of them started working with the government to become informers, and some of them started working whilst they were in prison, actually, to collect information for the government. And that was to be the most difficult and painful aspect of my stay in this prison, because we started staying in a prison where there were people who were accused or were known to have turned. And the relationship was very bad. Now, in this prison, where I was with other people, the harassment was very open. I mean, they did not hide that they're harassing you. They would beat detainees with truncheons. Detainees were physically tortured. We were stripped naked to be searched whether we're not hiding anything. You could be denied food because you did not clean the windows properly, or because the cell is not clean, there is dust somewhere. And we were treated worse than the common law criminals. One of the lessons we learned as soon as we landed in prison was that we must survive prison, that we must refuse to break down. And as part of our plan to survive, we organized the prison community into structures. And as a senior member of the detainees, most of the responsibility was on me. We had a code of conduct which every detainee had to obey. And whenever a detainee came, we told him that, listen, you are joining us as a community. We've got a code of conduct. And these are the laws of our section in the prison. And it had basic things. Every detainee must wash in the morning. You must be clean. Every detainee must wash his clothes. And there must be no violence amongst detainees. Before I went there, detainees would fight amongst one another for small things. And some of them, it would be out of depression. You find a person suddenly doesn't want to speak to anybody, is very irritable or short-tempered, and suddenly you are dealing with young people. And so we had a very strict code of conduct that never under no circumstances should you fight any other detainee, and you had to respect what we call senior comrades there. And we also learned sharing. If any detainee doesn't have socks or underwears or anything. Maybe his parents don't bring him. Would share if we have somebody has got an extra. And if nobody has got an extra, would organize from outside. We'll tell people that, listen, can you organize jerseys? It's winter. The tennis don't have this. And we'll just bring a box and give to everybody. So we started sharing there. And we had strict rules against smuggling, especially smuggling drugs. Maybe we are dealing with young people who, because of depression there, they think that if they smoked marijuana, they would be better. And they would find ways of smuggling that. And we had very strict rules that they, because experience taught us that if they search the section and they find that, they will punish everybody. And we had to make it very clear that apart from that, we must present ourselves to the prison authorities as very decent people, so that they don't actually think that we are criminals. That is why actually we are in prison. And with that type of transformation and organization, we started, for an example, education programs. We wrote discussion papers, which we circulated from section to section. And every paper had to be destroyed after being read in that section. We organized sporting events. We had daily meetings in each cell where we discussed any disciplinary matter. We shared news from outside. If somebody went outside for one reason or another, when he comes back, we'll share what happened, whom did you meet, what is happening outside. And we organized an evening prayer service. Every evening we'd pray, and we had a roster where so-and-so is in charge of the prayers for this day. In the meantime, we even started to improve facilities in prison. For an example, we knew that if you work well with this warder, with this prison warder, he is very understandable, so he can begin to relax certain things, he can begin to give you certain privileges. And we were able to improve our stay there, where, for an example, we fought for the improvement of the diet, to get ready material, and it was a bitter struggle. In our evening meetings, as I indicated, we shared events and news. Some were happy news. For example, one would get his sister visiting him, and in the evening we ask him, you had a visit, what did your sister say? You say, oh no, she told me that so-and-so of my brother has passed his examinations. This one has found employment, and would celebrate with such news. But sometimes you'd had sad news. Another one would get a visit, and when he comes back, you ask him what's happening, tell you my mother has passed away, and immediately we organize a prayer service, and we try now to counsel him, because the police wouldn't allow him to go and even see his dead parent. Every alternative Sunday, a preacher from the Apostolic Faith Mission would come to hold services. And for 12 months that I've been attending at least that particular church service, he preached on three texts, as far as I remember, which is Romans 13, 1 Peter, and another text. And all of them, it was to try and remind us to humble ourselves and to respect authority. Occasionally, I would feel so angry that I would wish to challenge him, but I always preferred not to, or not even remind him that actually I'm a better theologian than he is. It is difficult to stay in a close community for 15 months with more than 200 young people all looking up to you as a father and a pastor. It is very difficult. But those were the most treasured days of my ministry. I don't think any pastor would ever have such an opportunity, because all those young people were just characters in themselves, each and every one of them, because they all came from different families, but they were all expected to live together as a community. And it was very, very interesting to me. To be inside that prison and to minister to people who are grieving and who are mourning like me, that was very interesting. At all times, we dreamt about being free. And I think it's very important. Sometimes I regard dreams about a situation different from what you are as necessary. They can be subversive. Whenever you read the Old Testament and you read situations of oppression, always there will be dreams about a different order. And dreaming of freedom in a situation like we were was a very important thing, because it always brought that hope that one day we'll be free, we'll get out, we'll join the world outside. We longed for our parents, we longed for our wives, our children. We prayed that the world outside do not forget us. We were thankful to hear that at some church there was a prayer service for detainees. And we were even more delighted whenever we received cards and letters from outside. For me, the very first time that I was allowed reading material was when a church in Stavanger sent me a box of books, and prison authorities were just confused. They didn't know what to do with those books, because amongst them there were Bibles, and they didn't know. They ended up just giving them to me, all of them. And at this stage, I wish to commend the Holden Village guests and staff for their prayers and their solidarity work. You may never get another opportunity of somebody at the other corner of the world coming back in flesh and saying to you, it worked. It is a unique event. It may not never be repeated, but do know, wherever you are, whatever you may do for somebody in a situation like me, it does work. Because a simple thing like that, you do not know how much it means for a person who is disadvantaged, who is deprived, like we were. It means the whole world. I've met a number of people this week who have prayed for months during my detention and never thought that it meant anything, or never thought that they will ever meet me. And they were enriched when we met, and they said that, you know, I had just read this article in the newspaper and wondered, and I'm really grateful that God has so arranged that it is possible for me to come and share with you that it does work. I wish to say to you that however small your act was, for people in my situation in prison, it is unforgettable. Another individual who wrote to the Secretary of State, just out of her own initiative, to try this lady that I met a month ago in Indiana. She didn't know me. She had heard, she's a pastor's wife, and she decided that when she heard that there is a pastor in South Africa who is detained, on her own she decided, let me just write to Secretary of State George Shultz and hear what he can do. And I want you to listen to the response that she received.
This is August 12, 1988. I'm replying to your message to Secretary Shultz regarding the detention of Reverend Molefe Tsele. Reverend Tsele, a Lutheran minister in Soweto, was detained by South African authorities on December 12, 1986 under the State of Emergency Regulations. These regulations give broad powers to the police to detain individuals indefinitely without charge. Reverend Tsele is being held without charge and in solitary confinement at a prison in Krugersdorp, just outside Johannesburg. His lawyer is allowed to see him upon application for an appointment, and his wife is permitted to visit him once every 2 weeks. They report he is in good health and not being subjected to any physical abuse. According to Bishop Manas Buthelezi of the Evangelical Lutheran Church, Reverend Tsele's morale is as good as could be expected under the circumstances. Appeals by Reverend Tsele's lawyer to the Minister for Law and Order for his release have been unsuccessful. Although no charges have been filed against Reverend Tsele, it is likely he is being held because of his leadership role in the National Education Crisis Committee. The NECC is a leading anti-apartheid organization committed to solving South Africa's education crisis, the inequality in education for black children. The government of South Africa has detained virtually the entire leadership of the NECC and has accused it of being a major contributor to unrest in the black townships. We believe that the accusation is wrong and that the NECC is seeking peaceful solutions to education problems. The NECC was included in the organizations that were banned effectively by the government of South Africa on February 24th. An action we have condemned in the strongest terms possible. The detention of peaceful opponents of apartheid, particularly without charge, is a clear violation of basic human rights and serves only to polarize further the volatile political situation in South Africa. We have repeatedly condemned such practices and have called on the government of South Africa to end the state of emergency, release the detainees and other political prisoners, and begin the process of reconciliation and dialogue necessary for a peaceful resolution of South Africa's political crisis. Sincerely, George High, Acting Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs from the U.S. government.
When your liberties have been taken away from you, many things that you normally take for granted begin to have a different meaning. But more than that, even your spiritual resources grow and mature. The stubbornness to continue faith in God, even in the face of such suffering, cannot come without the grace of God. For many of us, we have grown out of this experience, we have matured. Many of these young people are poets, some of them are writing manuals or books about the experience in detention, diaries, which is something positive. But others were broken. They are physically or mentally irreparable. They are damaged. I know of many who are psychiatric cases up to today, and they started when they were in prison. Some, their families broke. Those who were married, some have developed health complications. It is indeed a painful episode. We tried to secure our release in many ways. We engaged in hunger strikes, we wrote petitions to the minister, and almost gave up. On Christmas Eve of 1988, at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I was told to go home, just like that. It was like being told that the war is over. There is peace now. Everybody go to your home. I couldn't believe it. And again, just like the days when I was detained, again, when they took me out of the cell and processed me, took my fingerprints and gave me my belongings, I was just numb. I just didn't participate. I was not excited. I was not sad. And the reality just dawned on me when I was at home at night that indeed I'm free and with my family. And I started to pray and thank God. Thank you.
Minutes for questions that anyone would like to pose. Yeah.
And tell us a little bit of what your education committee was trying to do and why the discrepancies exist.
There is one of the serious problems about apartheid in South Africa is that the government is giving the black people a special kind of education, which we call Bantu education. Now, it is a bad education. I'm a product of it. Basically, what we normally say that you go to school as if the teachers are babysitting you, up to matric. You can graduate from school without knowing anything. And more than that, what the children are being taught is unbelievable propaganda in this age. And so the youth, as you'd expect, they started to resist what they are being taught in school. They said, no, we can't read these textbooks, which misinform us. And so out of that protest on this system of education, my committee approached the government to say that it's important that we have an alternative education. And I was in that committee. We were looking really at an alternative education, which we called people's education. Essentially, people's education, we said that the community itself must contribute to what the children must be taught, and what the children must be taught are being taught must be relevant or must be in accordance with the needs of the country or of the communities where they are. And so we were coming with a very, you know, progressive model of education. And the government said that no, that model of education is political education. And then it opposed it. So basically, we were against the government's system of education and offering them very, without any secret about it, openly offering them an alternative. If you they give you an option this presently, whether you want to read in English or Afrikaans, but common knowledge has taught us that if you write in English, your examiners will be very strict on you because they'll be biased. If you write in Afrikaans, even if what you wrote is nonsense, you're more likely to pass your examination. So in a sense, they promote children to learn Afrikaans. Whereas after you have learned Afrikaans, you want to go to university, you know nothing, because there are no Afrikaans university textbooks. There's no country in the world where you can actually easily make use of that language. Whereas if you are at least fairly bilingual, in the sense of being very fluent in English, then you stand a good chance of participating in what we call global or international education scene. So the language that they would say that you choose both between English and Afrikaans. Sometimes you should strike a balance, like 50% of the subject you do must be in English, another 50% in Afrikaans. But they are very biased against those who do not want to take Afrikaans.
I remember, weren't you arrested also in 1983 or 84 when you were a student at the Lutheran Seminary? And could you talk a little about that also and the issues at the seminary?
I was arrested after a prayer service where I preached, and it was a commemoration service for the ANC guerrillas who died, and the community had a commemoration service, and they asked me to come and preach there, and I went, and the government charged me, actually. Then they charged me, and I was placed in jail, and I went to court, and the lawyers explained my case, that there is nothing, you don't have to be a guerrilla to preach at the guerrilla service, because according to them, these young boys are our children, and if they've died in action, like the white boys die in action in Namibia and Angola, they are given a church funeral. And so we held a commemoration, and I preached, and I just felt it's wrong to say that the church shouldn't be there. And I was acquitted after being in prison for, how long was it, Mudie?
3 months.
About 3 months, yeah. The trial was in 3 months. They didn't give me bail. They refused to give me bail. They thought if they give me bail, I will skip the country and go to exile.
Could I put in a commercial here? Our friend, the mutual friend Tom Soldner, who probably people know here, led our congregation after Malefi was released, and you know, we needed some more things to do. And he introduced us to a school in South Africa that is helping to educate the detainees that missed their education. And for about $3,000, I think we were educating 5 people. And money's well spent. So, and Patrick helped us get involved with that. So if any of the churches that want to go out and continue with some help, I think there's some opportunities there for students.
Good. Thanks.
Yeah, most of these are the same boys that who missed 3 years of schooling during their detention. And so when they come out of detention, they were now 3 years older to go back and join the grade where they were. And so most of them, actually, even when if they had preferred to go back to school, they were not accepted because they had a stigma that they were political prisoners. And the teachers cannot handle, they're afraid of such students, and they victimize them. So what has happened is that the churches are organizing special schools for those, what we call ex-detainees. And in these special schools, the intention is really to help them to pass matric, because after going through matric, they can then have a university entrance certificate and go to study at university. So the school you are referring to is one of the important initiative that is trying to meet this crisis of this bottleneck of this age group.
Was everybody in your group let out when you were let out?
About 3 months after my release, everybody was let out.
Did they lay any conditions on you?
Oh yes, that's an interesting incident, because when I was released, I was placed under house arrest with very severe conditions, and unbelievable. Like I shouldn't be with more than 10 people. I must report at the police station twice per day, morning and afternoon. I couldn't move out of the magisterial district of Johannesburg. I had to be there throughout, and many, many other conditions. Like I couldn't make press interviews or criticize the government or enter any school or education facility and so on and so on. When I left the country to come to the US, those conditions were still applicable. And so most of them were also released with some forms of restrictions, either house arrest from 6 o'clock in the afternoon to 6 o'clock the following morning. And it was very bad, because when you are under that house arrest and the police want you, I mean, you know, we were operating under very difficult days. There were death squads. Just that these things are now being revealed today, you read about them, but we couldn't believe it happening, you know, when we were released, because we'd find that this person has been killed by anonymous people, and we just didn't know what is happening. It's only now that we hear. And it was bad, because these young people would say, you know, I don't want to go home because I know that I can be attacked anytime. But then the laws say that from 6 to 6 you must be in home. So these death squads would know that I am there. No matter what, they will never miss me. And it was a very scary situation. We are fortunate that not many people died. Given the circumstances, many, many more would have simply disappeared.
Couple up here, yeah.
Oh, the letter that your friend in Indiana got was fairly supportive of you from our government, and I'm just wondering if you think that our policies reflect that type of support on a day-to-day basis for your people, and if not, what kinds of policies should we push our government to carry out in relation to South Africa?
I believe that it is important, and I've learned it from experience, to retain contact with individual congressmen, senators, etc., even the Secretary of State, especially on very, what we may call, blatant human rights abuse cases. where there's a clear human rights abuse cases. Now, the policy, the foreign policy in South Africa, as you know, the Bush administration essentially said that it is still studying what policy. Up to today, how many years has Bush been in office?
2 years.
Yeah, 2 years maybe. It's still studying it. So what they did, they put in on hold the constructive engagement policy of President Reagan and said that we are studying what kind of policy. At least they said we are not going to follow this one, constructive engagement, but we'll study which one to come. And so far they haven't really come out clearly, except that over the time they had tried to take this role of promoting dialogue. In other words, they retain contact with the South African government and open contact with the black communities. And the tone of my case is particularly positive because my organization, this National Education Crisis Committee, had unbelievable rapport with almost all the foreign government representatives in the country. It was embarrassing to the government to actually detain us because almost every embassy ambassador knew that we were doing constructive, positive job. And that is why it is exceptionally positive. And I believe that they must have applied some pressure so that at the end I was released on Christmas Eve rather than later on.
Yes.
Well, Levy, what organizations do you think are most effective and that you encourage us to support in the area of relieving the detainees' misery and needs? And which one would you advise against?
As a pastor, the South African Council of Churches has done great work. It has had a lot of detainee ministries department. And we, when we were in detention, we received a lot of support from the SACC. I myself was in a different case in the sense that my church continued to support me directly. But many young boys continue to receive a stipend of about $5 per month, which they used when they were in detention to buy soap, Colgate, etc., etc., and all that they received from the SACC. So I would think that through the churches, there are social services committees in the churches, ministries in churches. That kind of support can go to the church there, and it will definitely reach many displaced people like these ex-detainees.
Are there any organizations that you would single out as not being effective or being used or manipulated in the wrong way?
The situation is changing very drastically now. Those who were like that are running away, you know, are sort of closing shop. They were there, and most of them would be linked to what we call homeland governments in South Africa, like Chief Gacha Buthelezi's Inkatha movement. I'm not sure whether you've heard of it, those type of organizations. But because of the changing political climate, they are also trying to purify to make the house clean and purify their image. But they are certainly still controversial in the country. Any support through those organizations is seen as very not clean support.
Okay, we have time for a couple more. One here and one over here, I guess, or three. I'll give you three. Why don't we start over here and we'll go around this way.
If you could see into the future, if you have a gut level feeling, when do you foresee a one vote, one person happening in South Africa?
In 4 years' time.
Next.
Can I clarify that?
All right.
The reason is that the present government in South Africa, which for ages has been a whites-only vote every time white people were going to vote, alone as white people, I can never ever imagine that type of situation ever happening on earth in South Africa. The day it happens, you will see unbelievable revolt, because black people, the expectations are so raised now that they will never again stand the in dignity of sitting when the white community are going to vote for them. So now the days of white only votes is over. And now this present government, its term ends in 4 years' time. Now that is why I say I don't think they will have any one person, one vote when it ends. What they will do in between is to make an arrangement that when this present government's term ends, a universal vote happens. And that will be in 4 years' time.
Yeah.
Yes, it's very controversial as far as sanctions against South Africa. What's your opinion on that? I'm curious. Would you be in favor of sanctions or against them?
I've never ever seen a person in South Africa who, in his normal sense, including Bishop Tutu Mandela, will welcome sanctions. I don't know that person, me included. I know what I'm saying may sound confusing to you, but let me actually clarify. Basically, what you are saying is that you are talking in South Africa in terms of options. What are the options? You see, as a black person, if a factory has got to lay off people, I know that they will start with black people and then they will end with white people. I mean, this is how society is in South Africa. So any form of decline in economy, black people are going to suffer first. That is not denied even by anybody. But the argument now is that what is it that we can exercise to see to it that these types of things that has happened, like our detention, the disappearance of people, etc., can come to an end? What is it? Now, we looked at various options. You know, I hope I'll have a time to share with you what I call the memory of the struggle in South Africa. Basically, it's a historical background. And it will show you that there are over 60 to 70 years of negotiating, of pleading for black people to be part of the it failed. And now people are saying that it looks like the only way open is the way of the cross, the way of suffering, the way of sanctions. And nobody goes there willingly, voluntarily. Nobody welcomes sanctions. Anybody who wants sanctions is relating sanctions to an end. Sanctions are welcome provided they are there to end apartheid. Not sanctions themselves as an end. They are a means to an end. An unfortunate means, but so far a better convincing effective means. And so my answer to you would be that I do believe wholeheartedly that the situation in South Africa has begun to change the day the white people realize that the international community will never accept them for as long as they operate the way they are operating. The day they realize that their aeroplanes will never land on American soil, the day they realize that their gold coins will never be displayed with pride at jewelry shops, that affected them morally. And it made them to stop and think, what is it? And that actually has been effective. Now, unfortunately, people mix the way they argue about these things. They start the other way around and so on and forget actually why we want sanctions. There are not very few workers would say that I want to lose my job. I mean, what kind of worker would say that? But if you ask a worker, even my father, my brother, if you ask him that, would you rather lose your job or see your son being detained, see your brother being shot, which one would you want? He will tell you that my job means nothing to the morning, to the to the hurt, to the suffering that I know in any way we are in. So if, as for as long as sanctions are linked to ending apartheid, I am for it, and they are not controversial. But if sanctions are, people forget why actually do we want sanctions, then they are controversial.
There was one more over here that we... Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering what is happening with the NECC today. Are there people still in prison? And is there anything more that we could do as individuals?
Yeah, thank you. It has been allowed to operate legally now. It has opened offices in Johannesburg. It is I'm missing. I wish I was there to work. It is doing wonderful work. It is a researching alternative syllabus. It is producing alternative curricula. They are just working. They are preparing themselves for a post-apartheid South Africa. And I'm really proud to be associated with it at the beginning.
Good note to end on.
Yeah.
Thanks, Melissa.